Can a newspaper cover breaking news in the age of the internet? Ask any number of print journalists and you'll likely receive any number of answers. But after a week here in London we all hoped would never come, many in the industry are once again questioning whether the front page still resonates the way it once did. We'll find out more today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. I'm joined today by two veterans of the newspaper craft who, even in the digital age, still rarely manage a day without getting their fingers a little inky. George Brock is Professor of Journalism at City University London, former journalist for The Observer and The Times. He's also written for papers in the United States, Poland and Sweden. Jonathan Fenby is here, former editor of the South China Morning Post and now managing director of the China team at Trusted Sources. He's also the author of The History of Modern France. Gentlemen, welcome both back to The Stack. Good to have you with us, as always. I want to talk a little bit about newspapers, and we've got a bit of a London lens through which to look at things, particularly, obviously, of course, down to the events of midweek. Jonathan, perhaps I'll start with you first of all. We've got quite a partisan newspaper climate here, if you think of the proprietors and the editors. And they wear their politics on their sleeve. Some maybe wear them lighter than others. Does it necessarily impact their coverage of events like the Westminster attack when those politics are so stark for the readers who are observing these things?
I don't think it would affect reporting something like the Westminster attack. That, in a sense, is above, if you can say so, domestic politics, where you get, obviously, the political bias of the owner, who will usually make sure the editor who is appointed is of like mind and doesn't necessarily need all those kind of late night calls which people imagine are made between proprietors and editors, and which actually are very rarely necessary. But proprietors have often been very committed politically one way or the other. They have sometimes played a political role themselves, notably in this country, Lord Beaverbrook with the Daily Express, who was also a minister, of course, during the war. So you've had, you know, always that it's part of the British newspaper culture, in a sense, that there have been these politically committed proprietors. And very often, I mean, some of their editors are quite straightforward about this. I mean, I remember one editor of The Times telling me, I've been put in this job to make sure Margaret Thatcher is re-elected. So, and that's all, that's my main priority.
And it doesn't get much more explicit than that, I guess.
It wouldn't, not much more explicit.
We'll touch upon a very recent political appointee to the editorship of a newspaper in a moment. But just on this point, George, about the way that events are depicted by the press. I mean, do you go along with what Jonathan says? It was interesting even looking at some of the language that appears on the front pages of the papers in the morning after an incident like the Westminster attack during the week. And you see Islamist does this or that or that. That was on the front page of The Times, for example. I mean, surely the politics do, in a sense, come in, even if it's in some of these semantic questions.
Yes, but I don't think it's politics in the party politics sense. I mean, yes, most editors will have a world view, but that was always the case, and that's partly what people buy newspapers for. They know perfectly well that newspapers aren't restricted in the same way that broadcasters are. Broadcasters are required to be impartial. They're required in this country under the law and lots of other places to do that. Newspapers are not. So we have a kind of mixed economy of regulation, if you like, and we have a very long tradition of extremely opinionated press. I'm not just talking about newspapers, but magazines as well. And that's partly what people buy them for, because they help make sense of it, they may comfort them in their opinions, all sorts of things. So I don't think that if you have different flavours expressed in vocabulary, for example, that's necessarily a political slant. It's a worldview, which it might overlap, but it's not quite the same thing.
And I wonder, actually, Jonathan, on that point, does it sometimes deliver the most memorable, you know, front pages, the most memorable headlines? It's funny, we're always talking about the encroachment of digital. I can't really imagine anyone ever saying, do you remember the homepage of so-and-so website 20 years from now? And yet, there's no question that you definitely get that with the printed news media. And indeed, even this week, we saw some very striking images, very striking headlines, which will live on the memory. Does it actually make it easier that they can be more opinionated?
That is one thing. I would also say, actually, and here I show how old-fashioned I am, that actually the printed page does have a longer, deeper, more lasting effect, at least on somebody of my generation. And of course, you know, I'm an old fellow. So than the fleeting image on the
well, it's designed for
screen.
It's designed for permanency.
It's designed for permanency. You know, it's designed to have an effect that lasts, I think, for more than 20 seconds.
And George, on that point, do you think that newspapers, the proprietors, the journalists who work there, they're mindful of that, aren't they? They understand that they've got an advantage over the sort of ephemeral nature of rolling news, of digital news.
Yes, I think
because of exactly what Jonathan's talking about.
I think journalists of the older generation certainly think like that, and most particularly if they cover politics, do they think like that? Because members of parliament are some of the most technologically backward members of our entire society.
You generalise, of course, but
I do generalise, of course, right. But not inaccurately, if I may say so. And all of the industries that cluster around politics, lobbyists, PR people, and so on, they encourage attention to print. And, you know, it's quite, Jonathan's of course quite right, people remember what's on print more and people read it for longer than they read online. That doesn't mean to say that change is not going on under the surface as the generations change. But also, members of parliament are generally not people in their 20s. There are a few exceptions to that, but by and large, you know, they're middle-aged white men. And middle-aged white men don't like online news that much yet.
And is this the same? I mean, we're always keen to extrapolate this onto the global stage. Yeah. Jonathan, we mentioned, of course, you worked on South China Morning Post and others. The same kind of dynamics everywhere, both about that sort of veneration, that respect for print, but also on this idea that, you know, you can make a more lasting impression in print rather than online, even if online is much easier to, I don't know, for example, you know, look at someone like China, a market, such an enormous market, probably is easier to reach many more people and be more effective digitally.
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think there's several elements in this, and if I could say something which perhaps will sound like British special pleading or trumpeting, I think there is a particular nature to the particular British press that it has that has grown up, which gives still the newspapers considerable strength, which is they don't have in other parts of the world. And indeed, you could say from the digital point of view, that has been a drawback, because it's one reason why a lot of British print media outlets, newspapers, have found it very difficult, actually, to adapt to the rigours and demands of the internet. They've been trying to transfer the print model online, and it just doesn't work like that, as we've seen in many ways. You've also got other cases. I mean, China is a very good example. I mean, China has a very racy magazine press, if you like, and people press, as it's called. But the political press in China is absolutely stultifyingly deadly boring and so on, with very often the same layouts and the same headlines and the same stories on the front of 100 newspapers dictated by the Communist Party. And in that environment, the internet, social media, of which there are about 700 million users in China, has absolutely taken over completely. That's how news is circulated in China, and that will be politically one of the great challenges for the Communist Party censorship machine.
George, that strikes me very interesting what Jonathan was saying there about perhaps one of the reasons of a slower uptake or a slower adaptability for, say, the British print media into the digital. Do you think that there's an opportunity there for them to actually turn that to an advantage and utilise better those qualities that have made that adjustment difficult and play to the strengths, whether that's about being seen as an authority or having a more rigorous journalism, you know, in this era of fake news and all this kind of thing, which people go on about constantly? Is there an opportunity there for them to make more of a play and try and take that authority, that confidence, maybe into the digital space?
Well, I think you can see it happening already. On the whole, mainstream media, which have also gone online, major papers from the New York Times to the Telegraph to the Guardian, the Financial Times come to that, do very well in global terms online. Why do people trust them? And why do people go to them as an online source? One, because they're regarded broadly as reliable, even if opinionated with judgments added. And secondly, because they are extremely well edited and well written. And where does that tradition come from? That is, of course, derived from print. So that strength is not surprising. It's not confined to Britain. You could make exactly the same point about the New York Times, I think. It's a very well-written newspaper and well-edited. So those strengths play already online. The problem is not demand for these things online. Their problem is a business model problem.
Well, this is what I wanted to say. You talk about editing, you talk about good writing.
That costs money. Well, if you're paying people properly, which let's hope they are. And this is this old canard about, you know, trying to build a model that means that you can generate the income that which it costs to do these costly things, at the risk of kind of repeating ourselves endlessly. Jonathan, do you see, well, maybe here an opportunity then? We've seen subscriptions tick up, for paid subscriptions for access to the likes of the New York Times in politically turbulent times. Is that set fair to continue, do you think?
I think so. I mean, Donald Trump's been the best thing that's happened to the New York Times commercially ever in terms of online subscriptions. You know, since newspapers had it easy for a long, long time because they, first of all, would sell their product in return for money to the audience, the readership, and then they sold the readership to the advertisers. So they had a double thing, and that is breaking down because although you've got paywalls in places, the overwhelming, I think, expectation of people using the internet is that it will be free or cost very little money. And as you rightly say, good journalism is very expensive. You can see this, you know, the problem in the cost cutting, which has been forced even on the most successful online products. And then you've also got the problem, let's say, online. God, I'll get into very dangerous old fogey territory here, but there's a certain feeling, I think, among a lot of people reading online and using online and indeed writing for online, that somehow the kind of standards of responsibility which we apply to the written press, and particularly to the serious press, do not apply. This is a free area where you can say anything you like. And you can see that. For instance, when it began, The Guardian comment is free. I used to write articles for them. And then you had the below-the-line stuff and so on, in one of which, you know, I was regularly denounced as either a Russian spy or an Israeli spy or this, that or the other. I should be transported to the Daily Mail, people said, or I was a communist. You know, today it came from all over places. And I once met a group of these below-the-line bloggers for their Christmas party. And when I asked them about this, they said, well, it doesn't matter, responsibility. We say anything we like online and we should be above the line because then we could tell the truth. The two are rather contradictory.
I think they certainly are. Let's reflect back then on this idea of political, explicitly political appointments, certainly into the editorship of newspapers, which we touched on briefly at the top. And George, I wanted to ask you about, well, your namesake, George Osborne, though, the former Chancellor, editor of the London Evening Standard, the only London newspaper, we should point out. I know there's a couple of free sheets that knock around, but essentially the capital's only paper. What did you make of that appointment, first of all, before we talk about some other comparisons? I personally was pretty astonished to hear it. Was that your view as well?
I was flabbergasted. I mean, in the wake of the appointment, a lot of people said, nah, hang on a minute, guys. There have been plenty of people who've crossed the line between journalism and politics. There was a MP called Horatio Bottomley who was an editor. He went to jail later on. There was Michael Foot who led the Labour Party. He'd been a journalist and an editor while an MP. En route to that job, only two examples. There are plenty of others, and there are plenty of MPs who write, of course. But I'm pushed to think of an example, historical or otherwise, of somebody who has that recently been that senior in a government taking over a significant newspaper. Mm. And that's before we start to consider his other conflicts of interest. Everybody's gone on about how he should either be an editor or he should be an MP. I'm more bothered about the fact that he works for BlackRock, the largest asset manager in the world, as I understand it. A very high proportion of the business stories which are passed through the desk at the Evening Standard, BlackRock has got some kind of actual or potential interest in. That seems to me to be a conflict of interest on a kind of unprecedented and almost insoluble scale.
Insoluble? Jonathan, what's your view?
I think it is. I mean, George is absolutely right. Plus, you know, Osborne is going to be off delivering high-priced speeches, et cetera, et cetera. He's not going to stop other things. You know, and he's an MP. He promises he'll be at his constituency of Tatton very often. We'll see how often that is.
How's he going to manage that with his one-day-a-week advisory role, his 4 days at the newspaper? Yes. And let's not forget, it's not a London or home counties constituency. It's a fair way away as well.
And, you know, there's all kind of speculation that actually he wants to be mayor of London too. So he'll be preparing for that. Now, what role does the newspaper editorship play in that? But I'd say another thing, which is, I don't think you can edit a good newspaper when you're doing three or four other jobs, quite apart from the conflict of interest thing. To be done well, and all the really great editors, whether you like their politics or not, have usually been workaholics who've been in there 16 hours a day.
And also, if I may say so, I mean, I think he's going to find, never mind the kind of formal, whether there are rules against it or not, kind of conflicts of interest. The conflict of interest that Osborne is going to run into is if he picks up a good story and the Standard runs it, the people who are at a disadvantage because of that story are not going to talk to him again. He's either going to end up with a lot of friends in journalism and no friends in politics, or a lot of friends in politics and no friends in journalism. I don't really see how he can mix these two creatively.
And what about if we look elsewhere? You've mentioned the difficulty in combing the historical record to find an equivalent case. I mean, overseas, perhaps we've had huge media figures before who've had their finger in a number of pies. You think of somebody like a Silvio Berlusconi, either, who's seemingly occupied all of these positions almost simultaneously.
But they've usually come from the media into politics. You know, if you take Hearst, or even if you took Beaverbrook, well, he was a bit involved in politics early on. Those characters, indeed Berlusconi, who have become big media barons, and then they've tried to parlay that into a political influence. This is going the other way, and I think has a lot of perils in it.
What does this tell us, George? What does it tell us about our media landscape, the London media landscape? What does it tell us about our contemporary social landscape? To get slightly out of Stack territory for a moment, it seems like something that would happen in a banana republic. How have we come to this? An easy question for you.
Well, I mean, is there a bit of political cronyism going on here? Yes. But, I mean, it's hardly the only appointment of its kind of which you might say that. There's an awful lot of anti-kind of political class elite resentment going on at the moment. It's been discussed endlessly, I'm sure, on many programmes at Monocle and everywhere else. So does he look like it was a bit easy for him, and are people going to dislike him for that? Yeah, probably. I think another problem is that I think he's going to have to act like an editor-in-chief rather than a real editor. Mm-hmm. I think that's other people are going to do the work here. And I don't think in the long run that's going to help him. Unless he has, this is just a stepping stone into doing something else, either hitting his political enemies in the Conservative Party, probably headed by the Prime Minister who fired him in the first place. If he wants to become Mayor of London, as people rumour, then obviously it's a bully pulpit in order to create that candidacy. In other words, he's going to be seen all the time in terms of ulterior motive. Mm. And if you want to be seen as a good editor, ulterior motives are really a block and an obstacle and a veil to being seen like that. I'm not saying the guy doesn't have it in him to do these things, but if he does, he has to shed a great deal else.
And this is before we've even mentioned, of course, the proprietor of this particular newspaper is Evgeny Lebedev, you know, a sign of a sort of a oligarch family, whatever you want to call it. So that's another layer
another thing,
of complexity.
He has his reasons, obviously, for the appointment. But I think what George just said is particularly pertinent at the moment, that here we have Osborne editing, and he won't be a hands-on editor. I mean, I don't think he'll be deciding on the page five headline or anything like that, but giving general direction to the paper in a kind of editor-in-chief role of the only main paper in London there, with more or less a monopoly except for a couple of smaller city morning papers. And this is a man who has been sacked by the Prime Minister. We're in the middle of the Brexit process, on which he was very, very clearly in one camp, and the leader unsuccessfully of one camp. And what does that say about, you know, the role that the Standard is going to play in this position? And you could say that having this monopoly position should constrain the Standard from being politically swaying to one side or the other, as we've said. I'm not saying it has to be boring, anodyne, you know, blancmange in the middle, but he's a bit too typecast.
I want to talk about another facet, well, another challenge, which George Osborne himself may encounter at the Standard, and this is the challenge of additional editions of the paper, not just the price of print, the actual ink, which we know has spiked recently, but also the sort of the efficacy from a business point of view of running later editions when fast-moving events on the ground can overtake you so quickly. Again, if we talk about the London attack this week, it happened around late lunchtime. The Standard goes to bed, I think, late morning. Occasionally they do a couple of editions, but we understand they're going to resolutely focus on just doing a single edition per day. George, has the era of multiple editions, I remember when I worked at The Independent, sending three editions of an evening. Are those days numbered everywhere?
Yes, I think they're numbered absolutely everywhere, and actually logically and rightly. If people want something fast, they may not necessarily look at online. They could look at 24-hour TV. They've got a whole load of things they can look at, and indeed news radio, if you need it. So the idea that a printed operation can ever keep up with events like that is just a fantasy. So I think people are just acknowledging reality and doing that. However, there is something of a market for a printed London evening paper. They pulled off rather a good trick by turning it free because they had control of the distribution at the right points. And so many people go through such a small number of places, principally in mainline railway stations. So until the advertising market really started to get bad, that proposition didn't look too bad. Now, on the other hand, it's in business-wise in a bit of trouble, simply because the advertising is starting finally to drift away. And that's really very difficult. What do you do there? I mean, personally, my guess would be that it has to probably be a little bit less broad. It has to decide either to go down market or up market, choose its advertising market more specifically, and focus its coverage that way. Whether Osborne is up to that kind of fairly considerable editorial challenge and then matching it with something online, I've absolutely no idea. The one thing you can say is it's not going to be boring to watch for a bit.
Absolutely. I think that's an understatement. And Jonathan, on this bigger picture for newspapers, talking about late editions, and in fact, if we come back to dailies, wherever we are in the world, and this idea that, you know, during the night, you keep going, you know, back benches, yes, wrestling with what to put on. I mean, it's one of the great charms, that newsroom dynamic, hold the front page, all of these old cliches. Are we getting to the point where even daily papers of renown need to reconsider what their purpose is? And actually, they need to be a reflective, analytical, longer form read for the morning, because people have been barraged by this white noise from social media and so on. And newspapers need to shift gear. They don't need to chase the stories maybe anymore.
Yes and no. I mean, George is absolutely right, of course. You know, the day of rushing out, let's have another edition. You know, you can probably remember too, George, you know, during the first Gulf War, I think at The Guardian, we did six editions and I was there till 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, has the last train left from King's Cross and so on and so on. That's the glamour. That was the kind of phony glamour, if you like, days. Those have long gone because there are other much more efficient, much faster delivery mechanisms. So, yes, that is certainly true. On the other hand, you know, it's been said for years that newspapers, particularly more serious broadsheet, what used to be called broadsheet newspapers, should go for analysis, heavy features. That's the thing people will want to read. Yes, that is true up to a certain point, although there's competition from magazines, which have had quite a revival over the last 20 years or so.
And particularly news weeklies, and news, which are going through a real...
News, yeah. Well, and also magazines which weren't into news, which have kind of got into, you know, Vanity Fair and so on, which have got into more newsy areas. On the other hand, the last few months in Washington would argue against that in other ways, because the old-fashioned print media, particularly the New York Times and the Washington Post, have just broken scoop after scoop after scoop. And there's something in the nature, I think, still of those kind of newspapers which enables them to do so and devote the time and devote the resources and take the risks, which are considerable often in this, which you don't get really in online media.
So, George, if you're talking to, I don't know, students of yours who might even say, oh, I'm looking forward to, you know, my first byline on the front page where I've broken the big breaking story, is it a question of saying, well, yes, that should still be the dream, but you need to maybe reconsider, is that going to be a longer investigation that brings you onto the front page? But this idea of, like, the big breaking news story, is that something you should sort of try and almost dissuade your hungry students from dreaming of?
I don't think my students really think that breaking news stories belong in print at all. They're perfectly...
That's a sad day, though, isn't it?
No, it's not. No. It's one of those adaptations that goes on. We are conditioned by the late 20th century to think that there is a stable income for print and that, to come to that, a stable income for terrestrial television. Both those days are over. And actually, if you look historically, that period in the late 20th century, when Jonathan and I were kind of brought up as journalists, that was historically utterly exceptional. The whole of the rest of the history of journalism has been improvisation, experiment, extensive amounts of failure, and a very high degree of volatility. We've gone back to normal, in other words, in short. But to go back to the students, I think they think that print is fine, but what do they see succeeding now? Die Zeit, The Economist, The New Yorker. If major news institutions can make a better business of what they do, I think they will be principally online and particularly for news. They may print something. I doubt they will do it daily. They might do it twice a week, three times a week, once a week. And therefore, papers like The Times and The Telegraph and The Guardian are going to become more like Die Zeit or The New Yorker. They will reserve for print the things that you really can sit down in an armchair and read for a long time. High likelihood you might do that at the weekend.
Gentlemen, I could talk to you all day. It's fascinating to hear your insights. Jonathan Fenby and George Brock, thank you both very much indeed for being with us on The Stack this week. This is The Stack on Monocle 24. Now to the Netherlands, where we'll hear from Corine van Dunn from the brilliantly designed Volkskrant magazine from the traditional Dutch daily De Volkskrant. Corine spoke to The Stack's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about her magazine and a bit more about the Dutch newspaper scene. Oh, and of course, she reveals the cover of the latest issue on newsstands this weekend.
Well, the heavy political stories we usually leave to the newspaper because we have a week in production time. And of course, we have heavier stories, but we're more of the personal essays. When we have a heavier story, it's very personal. So everything in the magazine has to be personal essay or a personal photography project. The big interview, the big personal interview, that's all in a magazine. That is sort of the line we want to follow. Because otherwise, you could put everything in a magazine and we have to make choices.
Absolutely. And let's look at the upcoming edition of your magazine, which I believe will be on the newsstands over the weekend, Saturday, Sunday?
Yep, every Saturday, yeah.
So what's on the cover this week, for example?
Well, we have Mario Testino on the cover, quite surprisingly, yeah. He is the guest editor of the Dutch Vogue. But the Dutch Vogue is in Holland for 5 years as well, just like I am with the magazine. Well, he did all the photography of the Dutch Vogue and he came to Holland. So it took me a lot of work. But in the end, we got an hour with Super Mario. And it was a great interview. Well, we wanted to make a sort of alternative cover because, well, he only had 15 minutes for the photography, which I thought for a photographer was really short. But okay. But we sent one of our best people. She's, I think, the best Dutch photographer at the moment in portraits, Robin de Puy. And, well, she did such an excellent job, we can actually put it on the cover as well.
I'm very curious too. So you know, so in a way, you know, having Mario Testino, so fashion must be one of your big topics in the magazine as well, I believe.
Yeah, we have two fashion issues, two big fashion issues every year, and two design issues. And fashion is always in the editorial mix every week, yeah.
And I was wondering, you mentioned, you know, the Mario Testino worked with the Vogue Netherlands. How do you see, you know, the magazine and newspaper industry in your country? I mean, is it quite healthy? Do you see new magazines coming up? Or is it going through a little bit of a crisis? How do you see the Dutch, you know, more specific newspaper and magazine industry?
Well, the Dutch magazine market is not going very well at the moment. We have a few bestsellers, but and the broader range is actually going rapidly down. I mean, I used to be editor-in-chief of a weekly, a women's weekly. The circulation was like 100,000 when I left it 5 years ago, and it's now about 20, 25,000. So it's really amazing how fast it goes down. There are a few, like Dutch Vogue is doing very well on the advertising market, but on the their readership is not extremely big like in the US or right in your country. And, well, the newspapers are actually taking over from the weekly magazines. I mean, the more opinion-like magazines. Because the newspaper is doing a lot of background stories, the big research stories in newspapers at the moment and not in magazines.
Yeah, in a way, people, you know, perhaps, you know, in such a difficult and interesting political year we had with Trump, Brexit, you know, and even in the Netherlands as well, which in the end, you know, Mark Rutte won, but, you know, there's a lot of interest about Geert Wilders. How did you see the election, by the way, in your magazine? Did you do any type of more featurey pieces about the election?
Well, we didn't actually, but we're going to do in a few weeks. We're going to do a whole issue about the city and the surroundings where Geert Wilders actually came from, Limburg. And we're going to do a whole issue about that, countryside. So that's how we fill in our political background. We're not doing real specific stories on the political situation in Holland. We have portraits of Dutch people who just give their opinion about their city or their village. And we try to keep it light and beautiful, but still with a sort of secret mission statement.
That was Corine van Dunn speaking to Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. That's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producers, Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editor, Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome as always. Drop Fernando a note. He's on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next weekend. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for tuning in.